Hampton. This is Gemma Reedy.
We met each other in Israel last year, just about a year ago. I'd like to know how many here, has anyone been to Israel? Yeah, a few. And has anyone ever been to a kibbutz? Yep, the same group. Okay. Both of us were in Israel two times. Gemma has worked on two different kibbutzim. I worked on one and went once as a tourist. But mostly what we'll talk about tonight, I think, for just to be clear, will be the one experience that we spent on the same kibbutz, and that was a year ago this past summer when we worked on kibbutz Kfar Menachem, which is between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, sort of south, just in the Judean foothills. It's a beautiful area, sort of plain on one side and hills, foothills on the other. We can give a little introduction as to what a kibbutz is. Ours was a community of 600 people, approximately, who work and live socialistically in a cooperative effort. They have agricultural and industrial operations that support their community, and all their needs and some of their luxuries are provided by that corporate unit, the kibbutz. Everything is their housing, their education, their food is all divided up evenly according to needs. And it's a very, very interesting, equal community. Unlike Holden, which is a community, a worshiping community, the kibbutz is a working community. And work is really one of their major emphases. If you're a good worker, that's about the highest praise you can receive on the kibbutz.
You want to add to that?
I don't know. I'm quite happy for people to ask questions.
Yeah.
Because we don't know. We understand things, so we don't understand you're not understanding it. So if you fire questions at us, it's probably going to be easier. I mean, if there's something you don't understand, if you've heard about the way they raise the children and you're curious about that, if you've heard about the way the equality works or doesn't, or the way women are treated, just fire questions at us, because all those are exciting things to talk about.
How did you happen to go to the kibbutz?
But you start.
Oh, well, I had been in Israel, as I said, the year before, and I had friends who knew people on this particular kibbutz, so I had an opportunity to go and visit. Spent 2 days and a night there, met some people and really liked them, and saw it as an alternative, something for me to do sometime when I wasn't working. And that sometime came around last May. So I already had contacts there, and I went directly through the kibbutz.
Well, the first time I went, I was 18, I just left high school, and I just heard about an Israeli kibbutz, and people in England at that time thought it all sounded a bit weird and sort of odd, and I wanted to see it myself, so I was fed up with being told it was odd. So I went out and spent 3 months working as a volunteer and really enjoyed it. Then I went on to university, and there came a chance that I could apply for a scholarship to do some research. So I applied and won it, and I did it in Israel on how it was to grow old on kibbutz in comparison with growing old in a non-socialist community. So the second time I went, not just as a volunteer, but as a volunteer with trying to write a paper also, which helped me to get far more out of the whole experience than I had the first time, I think.
What kind of questions did you come to?
Briefly, I'll tell you. In England, the big war or the big issues involved in growing old are poverty, loneliness. I guess those are the main ones, really. And
health,
yeah, and the feeling of being redundant when you can no longer contribute with working. I'd say, yeah, those four would be the main things. And so in Israel, I knew that poverty and loneliness shouldn't even be much of an issue because you're living on a fairly wealthy community. You're surrounded by friends, people you've grown up with, people you founded this village with. But somehow I had the feeling that things might not be perfect. And it was interesting when I went there, as Anne says, work is a very important thing. And most of the problems that the kibbutzniks now have when they grow old are to do with work. Because when the man reaches the age of 65 and the woman the age of 60, there's still a difference, which I thought was interesting too. Although they say men and women are equal with retirement, they grade it this way. You're allowed to work 2 hours less a day. You can stop working completely, but your prestige would just plummet. No one wants to stop working. It's just not done. You can work a little bit less every day, 2 hours less a day. When you reach 68, you work only half time, maybe 4 hours a day. And the kind of work you do is different. From working in the fields, maybe now you work in a factory, which is inside and cool, and so it's easier.
You can sit down.
And you can sit down. And because the work you do isn't as strenuous and doesn't carry the prestige, your status on the kibbutz falls a little bit. Unlike over here, maybe, where people still respect age a little bit, and certainly in the Eastern cultures, age is respected because you're old. Over there, it's kind of not so good to be old because you're not pulling your weight. So that was a big problem. And also, the older people want to keep the plum jobs because that's where the prestige lies. But also they want to keep their children on the kibbutz, and the children want the good jobs. So there's this incredible competition between old and young for the same sort of job. And they have to come to terms with that as well, because you don't want to lose your children, because the kids don't want to be doing boring things. There are problems of loneliness. You can't just say because you live with 100 other people, 500 other people, you're not going to be lonely. If your husband dies, if your children move away from the kibbutz in particular, there's incredible loneliness, because despite what people might think about children on the kibbutz, it's an incredibly family-orientated community, far more so than on the outside, I think. And I'll have more to say about that too. And if you don't have children, you have almost no purpose, no one to be socialist for, in a way. It's okay, you know, working hard for all your friends, but it's much nicer to work hard for your children. So all those, I could go on for a long time and I won't bore you, but those are the main bits that I found.
Oh, you had a point too about housing, how they move houses closer to the
Yeah, when the older people also have, because they've been on the kibbutz a long time, they've, although they don't have
presence. Could you speak a little more slowly, please?
Sure, okay, I'll try.
Clearly.
Anne was asking me to tell you about the housing on the kibbutz, and that's interesting with regards to the older people. As you get older, as you've lived on the kibbutz for a longer number of years, you have credits as opposed to money. You don't have a bank account, you have a credit account. And the credits mean that you can have, well, that you've had more time to accrue luxury items. So when you come to being old, you have the best apartments on the kibbutz. You have nice furniture, similar to any house that you and I will know. And the old people are treated with a lot of respect in that they're given the nicer houses, and they're brought into the centre of the community as they get older. Because you can imagine 600 people living in a village, some houses are quite a long way from the central area, which would be the central dining room, the hospital, the stores. So if you're old, you don't want to go marching, you know, quite a long way. So they bring all the older people into the nicer central areas. And it's quieter there, and the families move to the outside. There are pockets on the kibbutz which you can say, well, the young people will live here, married couples will live here, the teenagers will live here, the older people will live here. And at one stage they were worried about this, thinking that it was becoming too sort of fragmented, and they tried putting the teenagers next to the old people, next to the married couples, and they drove each other nuts. And the teenagers wanted to play music, and the old people wanted to rest, and that they just didn't work. And they talked this through among themselves, and they recognized that they understood the problems, but you know, it wasn't going to solve it by putting them all together. So they were quite happy now to have little groups of age groups around the kibbutz. It works.
Older people on the kibbutz are really quite vigorous, yeah. And it was a sad thing that happened, but it really was kind of cute. While we were there, two old men were both hurt in an accident. Which they should never have been involved in. They insisted on climbing on the roof of their house to repair it somehow, rather than get someone, you know, some young strapping kibbutz boy to come and fix their roof for them. These two men, both in their 70s, insisted on climbing up on the roof of their house, and they fell through. And then for the next few weeks, we had these two old men who were sort of tottering to begin with, now walking around in hip casts and broken. They broke three legs between the two of them. They were, but they really are quite vigorous. They don't want to slow down at all.
Were they assigned, or did they choose to form the kibbutz?
They probably came from an original, how many? Maybe 200?
Yeah. maybe even less,
that founded it. The founders were groups that came from Poland, Germany, and Canada. Mm-hmm. And they didn't get land right away. This was way back 40 years old, isn't it?
Was no, 30 years old. 39.
Yeah. Yeah. And they couldn't get land right away. That was before independence. So they had to wait in camps. And then they finally got some land and began clearing the land and building. First they lived in tents for several years and got their first buildings built. And the people that make up the 600 now are their children and their children's children, plus more that have come in since the founding in 39.
And volunteers too, they make up.
And volunteers make up part of the community too. They're usually between 20 and 40, up to 50 volunteers at a time.
Well, do I understand that the parents are relieved of child care so that they can do work?
Originally, yeah, that was the idea, and still is, and also because one of their ideas about child raising is that the children be raised equally. No child to be brought up with privileges or luxuries that another didn't have. It doesn't always work out that way, because grandmothers in Canada send especially nice toys to one child, you know. But basically, the children are raised apart from their parents.
What about needs that people in the kibbutz have that can't be supplied by the kibbutz itself? What do they do for money?
They have money. They have
like an allowance. Like they have pocket money.
An annual allowance that
kibbutz does. Okay. How is that money generated? By things that they sell to the outside world?
Yes, by the products that they. It's part of their budget. They have these various industries: wheat, corn, cotton. Their agricultural things, their metal shop, their ceramics, and all these generate income. And that income is delegated into a budget. It's very organized.
But regardless of what you do, regardless of what you do on the kibbutz, what you receive as an allowance has no bearing to your own production.
Nope. It has to do with your needs.
Okay.
What's that little maxim that is so good?
Yeah, there's a little kind of motto that they have, which is, from each according to his ability, and to each according to his needs. So you could have five or six children and be working doing dishes for your entire life, and you're going to get as much as a guy who's a specialist psychologist who maybe goes to Tel Aviv and works outside the kibbutz, which is another issue too. Some people go out if they find their skills aren't needed on the kibbutz, if you are a specialist or if you are trained in. There's one guy who works for, is it radio, TV?
One guy works for CBS TV.
And they get as much, they pool all their incomes and they'll get the same. Well, not the same, but they get what they need.
Who are the volunteers compared to the other races?
We were volunteers, and lots of other young people, young couples, and students from Canada, all over Scandinavia, Australia, New Zealand, Switzerland. There were really very few English-speaking volunteers. At our kibbutz, there were very few. People who come to spend, like we did, 3 months, 6 months at a time for the experience and to see what it's all about. Kibbutzniks are people who have petitioned for membership and have been accepted by the community as permanent members.
It's surprising how few volunteers are Jewish. Often, say one Jewish volunteer would come and expect to find this whole brotherhood of fellow Jewish volunteers, and horror, there isn't one. The only people who are Jewish are the members, the volunteers.
Who sponsored this? Who started it to begin with?
I don't know that much about it. The kibbutz itself, you mean? Who started the kibbutz?
Yes.
The people themselves.
It grew out of Europe. The kibbutz movements grew out of the Jewish youth movements in Europe before the war. Even just after World War I. And they started.
I think 1920 was about the start of
the war. They began, young people particularly, who were living in the Jewish ghettos in Warsaw and all over Europe, wanted to go to Palestine. It was the beginning of the kibbutz movement is very much tied in with the Zionist movement. The idea to go back to the land of Israel, away from the ghetto, and establish their own land. And so, you know, lots of people from the kibbutz who were at the kibbutz came, in, as Dorothy said, in the 20s, really early. And they are organized movements. They're organized political movements. There are four major kibbutz movements, and they're drawn along political lines, from the most liberal to sort of moderate. And then the exception is the Orthodox religious movement. And they, if you belong to a particular political party, you will join one or another kibbutz movement. Each movement has hundreds of kibbutzim all around the country. And they, okay, go ahead.
Was it, including Marx there, there you go, is it, well, were they responsible or were they part of this group, the communist era?
I don't know how closely Marxism was tied in.
No, this doesn't have anything to do with communism. You would call it a democratic commune.
Yeah, it is very democratic.
Wasn't it everyone?
Socialist.
That's just socialism. That isn't just.
Yeah, no, that's.
It was coming from Marx, or didn't it? It was he the one that.
I don't know.
I should think many people
have been suspect. Well, anyway.
It could have, yeah. I suppose. I don't know.
But they wouldn't call themselves communists. They'd say that they were socialist groups aligned along the relevant political, one of the three political.
They have no loyalty to Russia in that country. Communist government anymore.
Not anymore.
Quite the reverse. The Russians, they want the Jews to come.
They want the Russian Jews. Yeah. They don't have any loyalty to the Communist Party in Russia, but they did at one time.
Yeah.
There was a time at Kfar Menachem where they had big portraits of Lenin and Stalin in the dining room.
I know, but
well, those came down, and they don't talk about it anymore.
What percentage of the population of Israel live on? 24%
of the population. 24?
Four.
Four.
Just
four.
Yeah. Do you know the exact number of the kibbutz?
No. Do you know how many kibbutz?
It's over 200, but I don't know.
I was going to say it's about 220, 230. It's not very many, and there aren't very many people on each one, so you can see how. It's had a huge impact, but it's very few people in numbers.
And can you tell us how they govern themselves?
I went to a session on kibbutz government while I was there, and it looked more than anything else. As she outlined, that they have a secretary, which we would call president, who is an elected representative, and then they have various committees for health, education, production, buying, purchasing, all the construction, various needs of the community. It's broken down exactly like my home congregation. And all the heads of those committees come together and they form a little council. It's just like our church council, I thought. And then each week they have a town meeting in the dining hall. The entire community is supposed to be there, but they don't all show up, to vote on issues. It's a very much a democracy.
Yes.
Yeah, those people, having come from Poland and Russia and all around, do they have a language difficulty, or do they all speak Jewish?
They all speak Hebrew.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of them have come from the United States.
Yeah, especially on the one where we were. Lots from Northern.
Oh,
more from Canada than the U.S.
Is English
the second language?
No.
Where you are.
Yeah, it depends on which kibbutz. On our kibbutz, I'd say English would be the third language. The second would be German. If you spoke German, you had an edge over a lot of other volunteers because you could speak to the old people.
Do these committees and these kibbutzes, do they have police powers and judicial authority, or do they just govern the domestic matters of the kibbutz?
The judiciary really is consensus of the whole community. They would say they wouldn't need police or they wouldn't need judges because it is a community of, if you like, brothers in a socialist community.
But if somebody did commit a crime, do they have police?
They'd call in the civil authorities.
They are not really a part of the government.
No.
Committed.
That's just, they govern only their own small body.
And only their domestic affairs.
Mm-hmm. Their economic affairs.
How are the non-Jewish people accepted into this?
Oh, like us, for example?
Yeah.
We were welcomed as strong workers and potential good friends. I don't know what the response would be if we were to want to join. I think it's a little more difficult for a non-Jew to join the kibbutz, although lots do by marrying in.
But that's what they feel uncomfortable about that. There was one.
They don't like it.
No.
Sort of watering down. But they certainly were welcoming to us and friendly.
Tell us about the age limit on joining a kibbutz.
I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah, middle age?
Yeah, you except for certain special circumstances, you can't join it if you're over 45, I don't think. Yeah. Because 45 on our kibbutz. No, was it 35?
No, it wasn't that young.
40 maybe. I think each sets a different rule. But they don't want the kibbutzim to just become retirement centers. They need those productive years, those most productive years, I should say, when people are strong enough to drive tractors and harvest cotton and clean out 16 chicken coops.
What kind of work did you volunteer for?
Eight.
Well, we just sort of arrived and were assigned to work. Gemma worked throughout the entire, 3 months, in the chicken operation.
I made the mistake of saying I'd done that before. And they said, good, chickens. And they had, 75,000 of these miserable birds, and they got them at the age of 25,000. And all they did was get fat. You had to just watch these horrible, they just ate. And every day you had to walk through the houses and take out the dead in green buckets. Big green buckets. Put them in the green buckets. Pull them out, put them in the rubbish. They got a bit hot and smelly. And then when they were 12 weeks old, they were considered fat enough to sell. So you caught the cocks first, which was great fun. Took a month, getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning and working through till 1 o'clock in the afternoon, sitting on the floor in a mound of chicken goo, catching birds and putting them in little sort of crates and sending them off to market.
Alive.
Because they had to be fresh.
And pecking.
Yes. And they weighed 2 kilos each. You'd have 4 in each hand and shove them in the boxes.
They grew pretty big. 2 kilos,
that's 4 pounds. Good, healthy. We got the ones that weren't quite so healthy to eat on the kibbutz, like the ones with broken necks and broken
legs. Damaged goods. I never worked in an area of such expertise. Although they would call in the underlings to do the cleaning job after these however many thousand chickens had been evacuated from the chicken coops that were long, huge buildings that just seemed never ending. We would have to go in, and they had already been swept out, all the straw taken out. I tried to do that one time, but it was too allergic. And then we'd go in with hoses and, we had to hose the whole thing down and sweep and brush all everything so they were immaculate for the next group of babies. Also, they had these babies they get from their own hatchery operation, which is a whole nother side of it. They have the laying hens, and then they have a big building where they hatch all these eggs. Big incubators, huge, enormous incubators. So I worked in both of those operations with the hose. I love that hose. That hose all the time, spring, spend all day all wet, which was great because it's very, very hot there. Wow. I had this nice cold water all the time. Another thing I did was, I think one of the most pleasant was picking oranges.
Oh,
I picked oranges the first couple of weeks when I arrived. And if anyone has picked apples around this area, I don't know what it compares to, but picking oranges is very, very pleasant. They smell so good. Just eat one anytime. And we'd begin at 6 and we'd be done at 12:30.
Farina's forte today was the dish. They had this enormous dishwasher. And Farina was dishwasher queen for about 2 months, as far as I can remember. Just in there organizing it all and desperate because compared with here, it was like no hygiene whatsoever. They were building a new kitchen behind, and it was a low wall, and then construction workers with dust and filth everywhere. And there's poor Farina rushing around like a kind of scalded cat, shooting the dust off her clean plates and trying to organize them.
Well, Holden is just so immaculate in its hygiene that the kibbutz, they don't care. They don't care. They, in the kitchen, they set things down on the floor. Everything goes on the floor. And the clean pots and pans, there was no room for them on the little trays. Oh, put them on the floor in the corner, and the construction workers are coming out, birds flying through the building. And there's your clean silverware, right? 600.
Cats wandering through.
Cats wandering out.
Jumping up here and there.
And there's your clean silverware, you know, 600 clean forks, and a bird comes in. Well, the kibbutzics wouldn't care, you know, I'm going to dust it off. And I just run it through the Hobart again.
Did all 600 people eat together in the same building?
Well, there weren't all 600 aren't there at one time, we're exaggerating. Because many are off at university, in the army, traveling,
kids, et cetera. Kids eating their own house.
Kids eating their own houses.
Oh, they do.
High school kids eat in their own area. They don't come in all at one time and sit down, what we do here. They had a buffet. All the meals were served buffet style from one time to another, and people sort of circulated.
You just come in and come out. And
yeah.
How about when do the kids leave home? You talked about the high school having their own little...
When do they leave the kibbutz?
When do they leave the family dwelling and move?
They don't ever live in a family dwelling.
But you were just talking about the families having these kinds of houses. The families live here, you said.
No, I think we said the teenagers live here and the couples might live here.
Family means husband and wife.
But when do they take the kids away from the families?
At 6 weeks.
Oh.
And I have another question.
No matter what.
No, not necessarily. Wait, what?
Would you, after listening to what you've been talking now, would you volunteer to do the same things that you did there? Would you clean out the chicken coops? Would you do all that dirty work in the United States for a new group? What was the attraction that took you to Israel to do all that dirty work?
I wouldn't do it for any group, but I might do it for a group that would give me room and board and would send me on traveling trips all around, say, the Ozarks or someplace, and let me be a tourist virtually for free, which is what I was able to do. I went to Israel because, A, I was always fascinated by the country and the kibbutz system, but also because, like Holden, it was someplace where I could come and spend a long time, and it wouldn't cost very much. All I had to pay for was my flights to Tel Aviv and back. I had my room and board provided for me, plus lots of other little things, shoelaces, whatever I needed. The whole time I was at the kibbutz, plus they gave me shoes and boots and other things. And then every 2 months they'd send us on these wonderful touring trips, bus trips. All the volunteers hop in the bus and off we would go to Galilee or down to the Red Sea. And they'd send along tour guides to show us all the historical and geographical sites. So I really saw the country.
And it wasn't as if the volunteers are second-class citizens. Everybody does dirty work. It's an agricultural community. There isn't an elite sitting doing paperwork. There's a few people who do that, but they're going to work on the dishes too. You don't feel you're being hard done by. You feel you're just pulling with everybody else. And as Freena says, you become part of that community as you do here.
And there's never a volunteer working at dirty work alone. The whole time I did dishes, there was a kibbutznik, right, always side by side. They're right in there with the cleaning the chickens and everything.
What kind of education?
So fancy.
Did you have to learn the language?
No, but I wish I had. I'd say I could talk to you about a third of the people there. And that's cut your community down to a third, and that's not as many people as you wish you were talking to.
What kind of recreation do they have in the garden?
No, our kibbutz didn't take us to Masada, but we were planning a trip there, and then I had to go just about the time. But you asked about the
education do these children get?
They get the high school on the kibbutz is standard Israeli high school. And it serves not only those children of the kibbutz, but children of a lot of surrounding kibbutzim and villages too.
No, just seven kibbutzim who use one school.
Yeah, they pool together cooperative for their high school and their elementary school. They seem to have a. It's hard to tell because we couldn't talk to any of the children. They don't begin to learn English until the sixth grade. Oh, and even then, we couldn't really talk to them, so I don't know much about what they were learning.
Did they have good supplies and all?
Oh, beautiful.
Mm-hmm. It's a very wealthy community. If you imagine a prosperous, several prosperous families, farming families in this country, getting together and pooling their resources and then sharing, buying in bulk, sharing the quantities. I mean, it's a very sensible economic way to live, and they're a wealthy community. They often have more money than they know what to spend on.
They've just built a beautiful auditorium, for example. Beautiful.
Cool library, wonderful theater.
A beautiful, acoustically perfect theater they've just built, concert hall on the kibbutz.
David Van Hurien was a kibbutzman.
Yes. Yes. A lot of the people that you've heard of when they retire to the kibbutz from which they originated. Golda lived on a kibbutz north of ours.
Tell about the time that the parents spend with their children.
Okay, you started asking about that too. Mm-hmm. Should we just run down?
Yeah.
The children, newborn infants live in the little houses with their parents until they're 6 weeks old. And then they go to a larger house that's called the baby house. It's like a big nursery, but 24-hour. One or both parents, but particularly the mother, is never sent to work very far from there. So the whole time that her baby is very young and nursing, she's right in the vicinity, so she can be going from her job in an office or the laundry, whatever, that's close to the baby house, and taking care of her baby and nursing her baby. And the father, too, they emphasize this bonding very much because of the fact that they raise the children away. They don't want the kids not to know who their parents are. They live in the baby house with all the other babies until they're 2 years old. And during that whole time, the parents are quite close. Sometimes mothers or fathers even have walkie-talkies that they can call them upon. And if there's a crying baby in the baby house, they will always call the parent. They'll take care of the immediate need, but they'll always get the parent there to identify with the child. Then when they're 2 years old, and when there's a group of 6 2-year-olds, they move them into other little houses that are called children's houses. And that little group of six, the first six babies that reach age 2, form what's called a group. And that group will stay together. They'll live together in a little suite of rooms in the baby house from the time they're 2 until they graduate from high school.
Is that boys and girls? Or?
Boys and girls together, regardless of how many of a certain sex in a group. They might be evenly balanced, they might not.
So it's like having 5 other extra brothers and sisters. You have your real brothers and sisters who are probably older or younger than you. And then these 5 really close friends, and it's the groups they form are valuable. I envy them, the closeness that they have.
But the parents still spend time with
the children. I'll get to that now. The whole, from 2 till kindergarten, the way that they reinforce that identification with parents is one thing I really like. Well, parents feed their children. They have a special kitchen that provides food for the children, and parents are responsible for and that food is trundled off to the various children's houses, and parents are responsible for going to the children's house and preparing their child's little supper, whatever it is that the kitchen has brought over, and sitting them down at their little table and feeding them and spending that time and sharing with them, especially at supper time, that is. Also, at 1 o'clock, since a lot of parents are busy working and can't manage lunch with their children, they have from 11 to 12 is a really nice time for all preschool children and parents that they call the love hour. And that's when one or both parents are excused from whatever work they're doing to come and fetch their preschooler from their little house and take them off somewhere. And so every day from 11 to 12, you see these lovely little sets of parent and 3-year-old or 4-year-old just sort of trundling around. They don't do anything special. They just take them for a little walk, sit on the grass with them, take them for a little ride on their bicycle or something. They spend that hour one-on-one until they're in preschool. Then from the time they go into school on, the children come to their parents' house every day, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, from 4 until bedtime, they're with their parents. And that's also tea time, because they eat a little bit later. And so that late afternoon time is devoted entirely to the children. And you know, if you're a volunteer who's been We were all given adopted families. If you go to your family between 4 and 5, no one's going to pay any attention to you because all they're paying attention to is those children. They just lavish attention on them during those hours of the day.
And the grandparents come in their own here because, say, the parents are working and they're tired. They sleep in the afternoon and the children will go to their grandparents who love it. And for the women who don't have to cook any meals, their big fun time is to cook cakes for tea. And the Hebrew word for cake is glorious. It's uga. And so the kids will come to grandma demanding uga, uga, which means cake. Mm-hmm. And so the grandmothers make them cake. And sometimes the volunteers will go too and will share tea with them. And it's a really close to family time. And there's, 4 hours from 4 till 8 of just parents, just children, or just grandparents and children to cement the whole family ties. But it's a very special time as well as the
One nice thing about it is that you never get the syndrome of a child coming home from school and having a bad mood parent there who doesn't want to talk to them because they're tense or they have a headache or they're ragged out from work or something. Because of the heat, most of the jobs at the kibbutz end up no later than 2, usually noon. Most people are done with work after lunch. And during the hot hours of the afternoon, between noon and 3 or 4, everyone sleeps or else goes to the pool, siesta. So by the time the children come over about 4 o'clock, the parents have had 2 or 3 hours simply to themselves to sleep, rest, take it easy, talk to each other by themselves. And then when the child arrives, they're relaxed and ready to spend time talking to them. That I thought was nice.
You have 2 or 3 children, you kept pretty busy on this.
Yeah,
you are.
They are.
That's what grandparents are good.
And those young parents really run around the kibbutz listening to their children.
Do they have quite many
It varies a lot. I know several women who have 5 children on the kibbutz. Others are younger and just have 1 or 2. I'd say 3, like here, 2 or 3. But some have big families.
Now, can they go through all this from house to house and all. What is the quality of the education that they've gotten in the training?
Well,
the children's education?
Do they turn out better than our children do under our
No. Not in my opinion.
There are many of them that are around behind the barn or something?
They're all around the barn doing
It's a matter of opinion, I think.
How do you judge better? It's very difficult to say that. They're skilled farmers when they're
thinking. Yeah, I think their education is good. You used the word training. And that was one problem that I had with child raising on the kibbutz. Again, it's difficult. I never got the child's side because we couldn't talk to them. Mm-hmm. We couldn't ever hear. But just going by behavior, kibbutz children are extremely rude, at least on my kibbutz, and demanding and loud. And part of that is because when we were at their house, we were infringing on their time. That was their special time with their parents, and we sometimes sort of didn't like us being there. Also, they grow up mixed up, just as we sometimes do. Some of them are directionless. They don't know. I don't think it's because of the way they're raised apart from their family. I don't know what the cause is.
Those changes. That child doesn't know where he belongs.
Well, I don't know.
I think he does that. The big thing I felt were people younger than us.
To whom he belongs.
No, they have a very, very strong family identity. They love their...
Well, okay, it's 8 o'clock. Who tucked, they've been with their parent from 4 to 8. Who tucks them in bed and where?
The parents tuck them in.
They really do.
And they have their own bedroom.
Yeah, the parents, and some of the parents hang around.
But some other house.
Yeah.
Just next door, like from here to Lodge 1. No distance, very close.
Do you want to see your children raised that way?
I don't really want to see my children.
I I visited another kibbutz for a few days up north where there was a modified version of the same plan. The children's, you know, the daily program of the children was exactly the same. The only difference was they slept at home. They slept at home with their families. And they seemed, I don't know. I can't really say what difference it makes, because it happened that at that kibbutz they all spoke English. And they spoke beautiful English, and they were very well-mannered. So naturally I liked that those children better. But I really can't say. I think I like their system better.
There is variation.
Yeah.
I think it takes more than 2 hours a day with your parents to really...
It could be, because the values of the parents are not shared by the children. Whereas I had, you know, every child has differences of opinion with their parents and different, you know, political ideas or whatever. But the children... Well, the best example, the idealism that founded the kibbutz, the pioneer spirit and the ideology of this society, let's build a society that'll work, hasn't rubbed off on the kids. They could care less. It's
difficult for the children, because for the parents it was really exciting to found a kibbutz. And they were, the children are the products of the parents' ideals. They're not the producers. They haven't got the challenge anymore. And it's, the difficult decision for them is, do we carry on with our parents' dream and make the kibbutz carry on going, or do we leave and we can explore and do our own thing? I think that's the difficult thing for people our age and younger, for the children.
They develop the feeling, this is mine and this is thine. Of mine and thine when everything is divided up even.
They don't have too much of that. It doesn't seem to be too important.
When they leave the kibbutz and go to the cities, what do they do then? Do they have their own homes?
They can.
And live with the lack of our many people.
If a child of the kibbutz wants to leave and go to the city, I can't remember. Does the kibbutz give them a little starter, a little nest
egg?
They
give them something, yeah.
They give them some money. They send them on their way. But
are they prepared to go out into the world?
It's a good question. They're not.
No. They've led a very sheltered existence. Very sheltered. And also they're not city kids. They're very much sort of from the backwoods of... The culture.
A job instead of having a tool, this is your job to clean up the
That's
house.
It. That's
yeah.
Especially.
They have a hard time. My kibbutz sister, for example, one of the family that I was adopted into, is living in Tel Aviv, and she was working the whole time I was there. She was working as a cleaning lady, and having a terrible time at it. She couldn't find an apartment. She just had a horrible time. Didn't enjoy it, but she didn't want to be on the kibbutz just then. And now the latest report is that she's working, doing the kind of work that she would do on the kibbutz. She's working in some cotton fields somewhere. But she wants to live in Tel Aviv. And
what about religious training for these kids?
There isn't any. Not on the kibbutz we were on.
They aren't perpetuating it among young
people. Well, there are religious kibbutz.
Yes. There are religious kibbutzim. They're the very orthodox. And there are also some kibbutzim that are a little bit more like what we'd call the middle of the road. They have a little synagogue, but they don't teach their children the religion. They sort of compromise. They say a table grace, for example. But at our kibbutz, they're
vehemently anti, really. The Jewishness for them isn't a religion. It's more of a nationality.
Mm-hmm.
They don't, that isn't a religious...
No one disciplines them, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's one of the problems.
Yes, it is the reason they're rude. Because the parents have limited time with them, they don't really crack down on them. The metapellets, the nurses that take care of them in the daytime, daycare people you'd call them, try to keep them in line.
Right.
I think it would work as long as they stayed on the kibbutz, but I don't see how they could be trained for a life in the world.
Yeah.
First of all, are the nurses female? And then my second question, are they all female?
You mean the nurses that take care of the kids?
Yeah. And the second question is, could you go into a little bit about stereotype sex roles? And I guess I've heard that they are, on the couple, it's pretty progressive, but then I've also read in other places that they're not so progressive, and that sex roles are pretty traditional.
Mm-hmm. I don't think the nurses are all female, but lots of times they need men working in the very, very heavy-duty jobs, and so they don't want to spare men to work with the children. There are men who work with the children, but sometimes they have to rotate out during a heavy crops harvesting time or something like that. There are far fewer men in child care than women.
What do the children have to entertain themselves, though?
Oh, they've got playground equipment like you've never seen. They're gorgeous stuff. But I wanted to talk about sex roles since you asked. You knew more about than me, though.
It's difficult. They try. The ideal is that you don't ever sex type either of them. The ideal is that you have both men and women looking after them, and that the woman can grow up and feel that she can working in the cotton side by side to the guy. But it doesn't happen so much. And the interesting thing is that more and more things like beauty parlors, like hairdressing salons, like fashionable clothes are creeping back into the kibbutz, which when they founded the kibbutzim, they were anti anything which would be considered Western feminism. They were anti the idea of women caring about their appearance. They were anti the idea of fashion. They had communal clothes. Like when something went to the laundry, it wouldn't have your name on. You just go and collect something that was clean that would fit you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And everyone shared this sort of these really heavy duty work clothes. You look back at the old pictures of the pioneers, and they look so strong. All these people with their bandanas on, and just like you'd picture them. But now,
now it's mostly women in the kitchen. A few of the older men work in the kitchen, like chopping vegetables. But the women gravitate to the kitchen, to the laundry, to the children. The men do the cotton, etc., etc. It's a shame that they want it that way.
The younger women will work in the real. There's less work related stereotyping in the younger women. But as soon as the families start to come along, then the women do tend to sort of gravitate toward laundry, the sewing room where they make all the clothes for the workers and stuff like that. And also what I think it is partly is that they still are a little bit, the older people there a little bit are still products of their original culture, and so they let them get away with it. What I think it is that the women are finding that they can get away with not doing the heavy work, and so they don't. They find that they can get away with working, sitting at a sewing machine instead of picking oranges. But someone's got to sit at the sewing machine too.
And a woman who does do a male type job, like Efrat, mm-hmm. she'll carry a lot of prestige. They like women to do that. They like women to have the old image of the kibbutz woman. They like all that, but it doesn't always happen that way.
Were you anywhere near any Arabians, and what was the relationship there? I mean, problems with the Palestinians or anything where you were?
I think our kibbutz was exceptionally good. We lived quite near an Arab village, and they had this scheme whereby the children would go and spend an afternoon in the Arab village, quite often, once a fortnight or so, and try and get to know the children in that community. They were Druze, in fact, and those kids would come back to the kibbutz as well.
Swim in the pool and stuff.
Yeah, they tried to do their best in that way, and I know other kibbutzim have too, but I can't speak for all of them. One thing that I didn't like was that one of the things on the kibbutz is that you're not supposed to pay anybody for labor. You're supposed to belong to the kibbutz and work because that's your village. But going back to chickens, whenever the chickens were cleared out, there's a lot of mess left to be swept up, and they employ cheap Arab labor to do that because the Arabs can then take the chicken muck and sell it because it's good cow food. And they would employ the Arabs to do that, and it's not nice work, and I didn't like that.
Yeah, cows can
cows,
live
it's
on.
High protein, it's good stuff. Yeah.
But you know, the way they rationalize that is that the these Arabs are making a living off the chicken
refuse that they're scraping up. The clincher is that they have to come in and scrape it up. They're not just going to, allowed to buy it in sacks. They have to come in and scrape it up. They also have other things that they didn't used to have in the old days. They have garbage service. Garbage truck comes in and picks up all the garbage. They used to do that themselves. They hire that out now, and that's contrary to kibbutz ideology. And when they're building the new kitchen, they employed a lot of Arab construction workers. And relations with those Arab construction workers was not good. They were...
If anything was wrong, it was blame the Arabs. Like, Frin lost her, had her glasses taken, and no one would even dream of accusing a kibbutznik of stealing. So it was obviously the Arab construction workers who took her glasses. That kind of thing.
Did they have a problem with crime?
Well, the kibbutzniks would say there's no crime on the kibbutz. But
they lock everything.
They lock up the kitchen. They lock up the kitchen and all the stores. They have big, huge walk-ins that's all locked up. Well, it's human nature.
They will say it's to protect them from non-kibbutzniks sort of wandering in.
But no, also, they wouldn't say that.
They would. They've said that before.
No, they know themselves
they know.
That
yeah,
well.
But both.
There are these old women that will come with literally bushel baskets in little red wagons and trundle them in on market day in the hallways of the kitchen. They give away a lot of produce and things that people can take to their homes if they don't feel like coming to meals. Then they have eggs and cheese and bread and fruit and vegetables that the people can take to their little homes. And some of these women come in with baskets and they just load them up with peaches or grapefruit or whatever they're giving away. You know they couldn't possibly consume that much fruit. But they, because of the whole equilateral distribution of stuff, and I think it's just human nature to get a little grabby, see if you can get some more for yourself. It's greed, it exists.
Is the kibbutzim movement growing, declining,
no.
or remaining the same?
It's not. I don't think it's even static. It's declining, and they're quite worried about it. Part of that is related to immigration. Immigration to Israel is way off.
And that's where people usually come.
And that's where the kibbutz...
And they usually move away from them.
Yeah, and the Jews that are getting out of Russia are not coming to Israel. They're all coming to the States. And people are not leaving their comfortable establishments in Canada and the U.S. to go to Israel anymore. And those that do are not going to the kibbutz. They're capitalists that are living in the city. So that makes them doubly worried when their children begin to leave and go to the city.
Along the Syrian boundary, they have...
Pardon?
Along the Syrian boundary, they have some military kibbutz.
Well, that I don't know about.
Isn't there a type of kibbutz community, not kibbutz community, where you can have some ownership of land, specifically in the agricultural setting?
That's a different thing. It's called a moshav, and it's a collective village. Yeah. And there you live in a village, and everybody owns their own piece of land, and you farm it yourself. And what happens?
I think
that's right. It's more of a cooperative. Dorothy's right. You get your own profit. If you work hard, you'll get more from it.
Right.
But it is a cooperative in that you can buy things in bulk and share it among each other. It's sort of between graduation between non-kibbutz and kibbutz.
Right.
Sort of the middle bit.
Do they have a problem with drugs and illegitimate babies?
Drugs what?
Drugs and illegitimate babies.
Drugs was a big problem, were a big problem a while ago. In the 60s, there was a lot of drugs on the kibbutz. The kibbutzniks blamed it on volunteers who brought in, they thought, the evil influence of drugs and despoiled their children. That may or may not be the case. But a lot of kibbutz young people were taking all kinds of drugs, and on our particular kibbutz, until a few years ago, and all of a sudden, the town council laid down a blanket rule. They just said anyone caught with any kind of drugs is out, O-U-T. And they kicked a few out on the basis of that, and since then it's just non-existent.
Non-existent at all?
very underground. I heard little teeny murmurs that there might still be some grass in the village, but I mean in the kibbutz. But yeah, anyone who's still smoking in the kibbutz is doing it way underground, because they know that they'll be out on their ear. And that caused a terrible rupture in the kibbutz, because children of the kibbutz who had grown up there were out.
On board.
If a kibbutz wants to go to college,
mm-hmm. Yep, the kibbutz will put every child of theirs through the university or give them an alternative, like go to Europe and travel and try to educate themselves, sort of.
What is the feeling when, let's say, a gal becomes pregnant and she's not married? Is the immediate reaction, abortion is an immediate reaction, marriage is an immediate reaction, raise your child, put the child in the system, you know, what's the reaction?
I don't know. I don't know.
We didn't come across that.
I didn't know of any. While we were there, in the course of the 6 months, I think there are probably some fast marriages. Abortion is absolutely illegal in Israel, I think, and it'd be very contrary to religious law. And Israel is a country that has state religion. You don't have any choice in the matter. There are certain religious laws that I'm sure would prohibit abortion.
But you said there was no religion of any kind in that.
Not on the kibbutz, but in the state of Israel.
And the kibbutz is only 4% of that whole state. And the religious influence is much greater outside the kibbutz.
And so religion is a political power in Israel.
How about alcoholism?
There's a lot of drinking among the young people. The older people, the pioneers are staunchly against any kind of alcohol consumption. It just goes contrary to their ideology. You can't function or be a contributing member as a worker if you drink much. That's what I got from Israel anyway. My kibbutz father would just cringe. He'd drink a little glass of wine, but he could hardly stand it. But the young kids drink a lot of beer.
Ours was especially boozy, because there was one guy who made his own wine. And he was always organizing volunteer parties, and it would be part of the bit would be to go along to Juki's, he was called, and have too much wine.
He made the most wonderful wines out of rose petals and orange blossom.
And raisins. They're incredibly potent and quite disgusting, but
And sometimes he'd pour a few of them together and throw in some oranges and grapefruit and call it killer sangria.